Comics. Comics. Welcome to ORP, otherwise known as Omen Revelations Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Nunley.
And I'm your co-host, Steve Sellers. On ORP, we like to talk about geek stuff, pop culture, including movies and TV series, as well as comic books and comic characters. But that's not all, is it, Mike?
No, it's not, Steve. We're also writers for Omen Comics and Revelation Comics. So we like to talk about both writing and our comics. So podcast and chill with us. Welcome back to our Planet of the Apes discussion. Now, this is part two of this discussion and the finale on the topic. In the first episode, we talked about the original five films. And if you haven't listened to that, I would recommend you go back and check that out before you listen to this episode. In this episode, we're going to touch briefly on the Planet of the Apes TV series from 1974, Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes, and the latest trilogy, Rise, Dawn, and War for the Planet of the Apes. But before we get started on part two here, was there anything you wanted to say, Steve?
Sure. Going through these films, I'm impressed at how well the Ape series holds up. Aside from one exception we're going to talk about soon, most of these films are honestly pretty good, especially things like the last films we're going to discuss. All in all, I feel like Apes has done very well for itself, given that it's a long-running franchise.
I can agree with that. Overall, I'd say that its status as a classic franchise is well-earned, even with that one blemish we'll discuss. But before we get into all of that, we have to talk about one more thing connected to the original five films, and that's the TV series on CBS in 1974, and again in reruns during the 80s. Now, I have not watched the Planet of the Apes TV series since I was a boy in the 80s, and actually not many people know about it, to my knowledge. In fact, I don't think anybody but me and my family have ever talked about it, to my knowledge. Like, I've never heard a single other person. The series, which only ran for one season, starred Roddy McDowall, who had previously played both Cornelius and Caesar in the films, came back to play Galen. Galen was a young chimpanzee that was sent by Counselor Zaius, played by Booth Coleman, with Security Chief Urko, played by Mark Leonard, to ensure the safety of the two humans, Colonel Alan Burden, played by Ron Harper, and Major Peter J. Burke, played by James Naughton, who survived a crash landing on Earth in 3085. In a lot of ways, this series really just served to relive a lot of the moments from the films with slightly different scenarios and different characters. However, it is the first mention of a time warp, which I believe comes up again in 2001's Planet of the Apes by Tim Burton. It was also something you brought up yesterday in part one of this discussion as a better explanation for how Caesar and Cornelius ended up going back in time the exact same year that Taylor had left from. Some of the similarities between the films and the franchise include three astronauts crashing on a future Earth and one of the astronauts dying in the process. The two surviving astronauts eventually figure out that they are on Earth in the future and that despite the teachings of the apes, apes have not always been the dominant species on the planet. There's even an orangutan named Zaius, who is an analog of the character of the same name from the movies.
I'll be honest, I wasn't even aware of the series at all until recently. I don't even remember it being on, but it's possible I could just have forgotten it completely. I am glad they got Roddy McDowall back for it. I get the feeling that McDowall really loved the franchise and the characters he was playing, because he's the most consistent thing in the entire series until the reboots. It sounds like the casting was solid, at least. I mean, Mark Leonard is an actor I've enjoyed in his Star Trek roles, Serico most of all. Balance of Terror is still one of my favorite original series episodes, and Leonard's performance as the Romulan commander was epic in that episode. It sounds like the TV series trying to maintain the continuity of the films while keeping more or less to the formula of the first two movies. Still, without having seen it myself, I can't comment too much on how well it was done.
So what you're saying is you're right. It was basically just me and my family that watched it. And nobody else was there.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. As I recall, it felt a lot like watching the first two films and maybe even a bit of Battle for the Planet of the Apes as well, particularly with the Ape City stuff. Considering the films were over in 1973 and there were still a fair amount of people who couldn't get enough of the series, the television show really worked as a great nicotine patch, if you will. It helped ease us off of it. I think this is especially true, as you mentioned, because Roddy McDowall was in it. His consistency throughout the series really keeps that emotional attachment. But if we could move on to the next time we get to see more Planet of the Apes content, in 2001's Planet of the Apes by Tim Burton. The movie was loosely adapted from Pierre Boulle's 1963 novel of the same name, and in my opinion, it was a bad remake of the 1968 film. The story and the characters in it were totally different, and it just ruined it for me. I will totally praise Rick Baker's prosthetic makeup designs in the film and the set designers. They were amazing, and Tim Burton delivered as always. Plus, but oh my gosh, it frustrates me even to get the sentence out. Do not get me started on Caesar showing up at the end in a rocket and that rather confusing ending. They say he's on the planet Ashlar the whole time and then reveal that Ashlar, a completely different planet, was actually Earth, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Planet of the Apes was released theatrically July 27th in 2001 by 20th Century Fox. The film received mixed reviews from critics who criticized both the confusing plot and the ending, as I just did. Despite its financial success, Fox chose not to produce a sequel and later rebooted the franchise in 2011 with Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Understandably so. I was not impressed with this movie either. I mean, I can appreciate what Tim Burton brought to the film on a visual level, and I agree that the prosthetic work is great. I mean, the supporting cast is really good as well. Between the likes of Helena Bonham Carter, David Warner, Michael Clark Duncan, and Paul Giamatti. I like the opening score by Danny Elfman, too, but the story just didn't work for me. I mean, the pacing of the movie is really off. It takes its sweet time with the setup in 2029, and then it completely rushes from there to Marky Mark getting captured by the apes. I mean, the shaky cam that you see in the scenes with the caged humans is horrendous. You can't even make out most of the actors in the cages because the camera is flying all over the place and it doesn't settle on anyone long enough to make anyone out, which is bizarre because it never does this with the apes. I hated the idea that the other humans could speak. I mean, it diminishes what makes the main character special if anyone can do it. Also, having one of the apes do a version of the "get your damn paws off me, you damn dirty ape" line was positively groan worthy, and it took me out of the film. And that's all before we start getting into the twist. And the writers of this film are no Rod Serling or Paul Dean, like anyone could be, but still. This was a remake that didn't need to be made and probably shouldn't have been made. But fortunately, there was a light at the end of the tunnel. So why don't we get into the reboot trilogy?
Oh, I'd love to. In fact, I've actually been dying to get to these films since we started this. So in the words of Joker, here we go. 2011's Rise of the Planet of the Apes is a reboot of the franchise and tells the story of how all of it got started, which, if you remember, was a question asked more than once in the franchise, all the way back to Taylor asking, "Who are you and how the hell did this upside-down civilization get started?" Rise was directed by Rupert Wyatt from a screenplay by Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver. It is a reboot of the Planet of the Apes film franchise, which is again based on the 1963 novel Planet of the Apes by Pierre Boulle. It stars Andy Serkis as Caesar, the leader of the apes, alongside James Franco as Dr. Will Rodman, who created the ALZ-112, the serum that ultimately gives Caesar his intelligence. And there's one cool thing about his character's last name. Rodman, or Rodman, was a reference to Rod Serling, who co-wrote the screenplay for the original film. But back to the cast. Frida Pinto played Dr. Caroline Arana, a primatologist who begins a relationship with Will. John Lithgow, who I love, played Charles Rodman, Dr. Will Rodman's dad with Alzheimer's. Brian Cox was John Landon, the cold and merciless manager of the San Bruno Primate Shelter, where Caesar is confined. Tom Felton, who you might recognize from his role as Malfoy in the Harry Potter series, and plays an equally detestable character in John Landon's son, Dodge Landon, and David Oyelowo played Stephen Jacobs, Will's supervisor at Gensis.
I was really reluctant to get into the reboot trilogy at first, just because I felt the original film cast such a huge shadow. And this movie does admittedly thread some of the same ground that we saw in Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, though there are some clear differences as well, to be fair. At the same time, I felt like this movie tells the story very well, and I think the casting choices all work. I don't know what it is about Tom Felton that he keeps playing these awful bully characters, but he does them really well, which is funny because from all the accounts I've heard, Tom Felton is a really nice guy when he's not in character.
You know, that's funny. And it's actually not the first time I've heard stuff like that. Angus Scrimm, who played the very scary tall man in the Phantasm franchise. I mean, he's just standing there. He can be scary, is apparently one of the kindest, gentlest people you will ever meet. It is odd though, how well these guys are able to portray those roles being so different from the characters in real life. But speaking of great actors, I have to take a moment to talk about the great Andy Serkis. He was originally brought on to the Lord of the Rings because of his voice, but they realized that his performance doing the voice would be great to see on camera as Gollum. And so Serkis kind of fell into the motion capture business at that point. But he is such a good actor and has such a mastery of his body and his face that he has since risen to the top of his field. Everyone on the set of Rise praised his performance, not just because it was good, but also because Serkis' performance made acting alongside him very easy to do, as very little imagination needed to be applied with how spot on his performance was. But from the perspective of a moviegoer, his performance perfectly encapsulated the journey of Caesar's character in the film, using his expressions, posture, and body movement alone.
He did that for sure. There's no better actor for motion capture than Andy Serkis. Apparently, to prepare for the role, he studied how actual chimpanzees move and behave so he could get the movements for Caesar down just right. And to be honest, I love how the apes in this movie really seem more like apes than they did in the original series. I mean, they're swinging from high branches, using their manual dexterity to do things humans can't. So when you get moments like the ape swinging on the underside of the Golden Gate Bridge, it feels like more of a realistic take. As the bridge scene started, I started asking why the apes don't just swing under the bridge. And then the apes actually do it. I was impressed by that. And actors like Serkis, who gets how mocap works and knows how to play great CGI characters, bring a level of realism that the technology alone just can't do.
We are in 100% agreement on the Golden Gate Bridge scene, as well as the amazing realism in their movements and the excellent stratagem of the apes. With you saying that they actually studied apes to learn that, it makes a lot of sense. I guess in this case, it was human see, human do. A scene that really struck me in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, again because of Serkis, was when Caesar sees the neighbor pointing his finger in Charles' chest and yelling at him. He gets ultra protective and gets full on primal on the neighbor and just beats the hell out of him. A savage side of Caesar came out of him for a couple of minutes, but you could see it in Caesar's eyes and face when he realized how far he had gone. He looks up and sees everyone backing away from him, terrified, and like a child, he runs to Charles' arms for safety and comfort. He clearly did not mean to terrify everyone, as when Caesar saw that he had done that, he backed off and looked a little ashamed even. Perhaps even scared of himself and what came out of him. Honestly, seeing that followed by Will taking him into that facility with Caesar really made you feel for Caesar. You see right away that Caesar is uncomfortable even being there and is reluctant to take Will's hand, but he decides that he trusts Will and takes his hand anyway, and that's the real heartbreaker here. Caesar put his trust in who he believed to be his father, not knowing or understanding what was happening. In fact, when they take him into the room with the tree and he sees things to climb on, Caesar initially believes that he's getting to play, like when they used to take him to the Muir Woods National Monument. But then he realizes this is no wide open space, and Will, his father, just locked him inside a room. He immediately runs to the window, begging to go home, and you can see the sense of betrayal in his face as Will explains that he's going to leave him there. But before you go thinking he's just an animal, imagine how a human child would feel if their father did that to them, because Caesar is highly intelligent and aware. Caesar probably knew that it had something to do with his actions, but my guess is that he knew he had gone too far, but felt that attacking the neighbor was justified as he was defending Charles. I personally have a very strong need to protect and defend my friends and family. So this perception of the scene is clearly projecting, but I have to say that's how I see this scene.
That's a pretty fair take, I would say. The real problem is that while Caesar may be highly intelligent, he doesn't understand human society or how civilization functions. He doesn't know why he's been forced to relocate to the animal shelter. So all he has is his trust and will that everything will turn out okay. And then it doesn't. as Caesar ends up locked in the cage and then abused by his so-called caretakers, quote unquote. From his perspective, I mean, he can't make any sense of it, and he doesn't understand why his father would do this to him. Eventually, the confusion makes way to anger as he interacts with the other apes and starts feeling kinship with those of his own kind, which leads into the next point you wanted to make, Mike.
Oh, it certainly does. When that asshole Dodge locked Caesar in his cell that first night, my heart was just broken. But that marks a turning point for Caesar. Will told him that he would be back, and it seems pretty obvious that Caesar held on to that as a means of getting through the wait. I think this is exemplified in Caesar drawing the window from the attic of his home with Will on the wall of his cell. He has forgiven Will for leaving him there on the unspoken grounds that Will will take him from there when he returns. I say this because when Will comes to visit but does not take Caesar home, Caesar angrily erases the window off the wall. That it was symbolic of him letting go of his life with Will, and you could tell that it hurt him to do so. But from then on, Caesar devoted himself entirely to the other apes, so much so that when Will did come back to take him home, Caesar got up as if he would go with Will, but then looked around and saw the other apes and stepped back in his cell and closed the door.
What Caesar does here is a heroic act of self-sacrifice. I mean, by the time that Will is finally able to take Caesar home, Caesar has bonded with his fellow inmates, and he's already started to put his plan into motion. He's grown to care about his own kind, and he wants to end their suffering, having taken on the role as their leader. When he does have the chance to leave, he refuses because he feels an obligation to see the plan through and give his people freedom, even if it means subjecting himself to more pain at the hands of Dodge. I ended up respecting Caesar a lot for that decision, even if it ended up creating a distance between Caesar and the human who raised him. I doubt there are many people, human or ape, who would be willing to do that.
You make a great point there. Completely selfish acts are very respectable as well as inspirational. Seeing another person do those things, at least for me and I assume for others, inspires me to want to do better and to be more selfless. And actually, that leads right into my next point. I have to comment on the loyalty and dedication to Caesar that came over the other apes. It started with setting things right with Rocket, the alpha ape who attacked Caesar and ripped off his shirt when he first joined the other apes. Rocket had to be put in his place. That's just the law of the jungle. But right away, Caesar was not cruel or mean to Rocket, who had beat him. When Rocket asked for forgiveness, Caesar immediately gave it. Then, defying the animal caretaker, Dodge Landon, by throwing food at him. By the way, Dodge Landon is a direct reference to two of the astronauts in the 1968 Planet of the Apes film. But back to the film. As Dodge then blasted him with a fire hose, I believe that painted Caesar in both the light of as a potential leader, as he defied the current leader, but also as a bit of a martyr, although it's more of a suffering than death in this particular case, for taking the fire hose from Dodge. And you'll note that the apes all got angry at Dodge for doing that. And by the way, that scene was also a play on the apes spraying Taylor with the fire hose after they took Nova with the hose in the 68 original. But back to Caesar taking power. Giving the cookie to everyone was a great move. The leader feeds his people. And then giving him intelligence. A leader takes care of his people and enables them to take care of themselves. And things step up a whole new level. In Escape from Planet of the Apes, from 1972, Cornelius says that in the sacred scrolls, it is well documented that the first ape to speak was Aldo, and he said no. Now, you'll note that that isn't actually true in the franchise. The first ape to speak was Caesar, and after him, it was Lisa. But that's not my point. If I remember correctly, in the original franchise, apes grew to hate being told no by humans because of their time as abused slaves. And for Caesar to say that to a human was pretty monumental from the perspective of the apes. But I'm sidetracking a bit here. The makers of Rise of the Planet of the Apes really built a whole movie around that moment when Caesar rises up, grabs Dodge's arm, and shouts no in his face with that ferocious defiance. And of course, there was another nod to the original film in that moment as Dodge repeated Taylor's famous line, "Take your stinking hand off me, you damn dirty ape." That was the moment in the words of the director, Rupert Wyatt, when all the other apes stood up and said, "I am Spartacus." And they are 100% behind him too, especially after he shows them all the way out. I mean, that gorilla jumped on the helicopter through a hail of bullets, didn't flinch like a dedicated soldier. And Caesar was clearly affected by the gorilla's sacrifice. And I imagine there was regret that some like him had to die for their freedom. But then you just know they've come too far to back down at that point. Now that Caesar has Koba kick the helicopter off the ledge, but killing the executive.
Definitely agreed on that, especially when talking about Caesar and his leadership qualities. I mean, he's never needlessly cruel, having learned the value of compassion from his time with the Rodmans. He generally shows mercy to other apes, even if he's less merciful to certain humans, as in the case of Jacobs. Even if it isn't officially codified as the sacred law yet, Caesar is definitely thinking of ape shall not kill ape. He's generous to those who follow him, even at his own expense. I also want to add that Caesar always shares the risks and leads from the front. He's willing to put himself at the same risks as his followers. He's also a pretty smart tactical thinker. Caesar takes advantage of the things apes can do that normal humans can't. So you see the apes swinging from trees or taking advantage of high terrain. He knows which apes to use where, like using the gorillas to move the bus or taking advantage of having the orangutan swing under the bridge. The cops towards the end are guilty of what Spock calls two-dimensional thinking, expecting the apes to go straight to the bridge directly towards them. But Caesar is a three-dimensional thinker, and he has one group of apes go up where the fog can hide them, and then below where the cops don't think to guard against. I thought splitting the group and going around the cops was a really clever plan. I mean, all in all, Caesar is a pretty effective leader in this film.
Oh, he is a great leader in Rise for sure, and surprisingly a very tactical leader. I'm not actually sure where he learned that stuff from, but he seems to be going at that attack like a seasoned pro. If we could switch gears, though, I'd like to talk about the rather large amounts of homages and references in Rise. Rise of the Planet of the Apes is in many ways more than a reboot of the franchise. It is a tribute to the original 68 film, and there are things sprinkled throughout the film from those old movies to pay homage. Things like when Caesar is playing up in his attic, we see him playing with the toy Statue of Liberty, an obvious nod to the famous scene at the end of the original film. Caesar's mother's name, Bright Eyes, is a direct reference to the name Zira gave to Taylor in the 68 film. Koba aggressively taking and eating the treat from the scientist mirrors what we see the other humans doing when Cornelius and Zira are giving treats out in the original film. The craft that Taylor, Dodge, and Landon go to the future on is officially known as Liberty One and nicknamed the Icarus. As a nod to that, Icarus was the name of the space shuttle we see launching into space on its way to Mars in the TV news and where we briefly saw the astronauts. In addition to the nod, screenwriter Rick Jaffa said that the ship was a version of the spaceship from the 68 Planet of the Apes film and was called Icarus as a deliberate hint to a possible sequel. Or the scene where Dodge Landon sprays Caesar with the fire hose and his cell mirrors when the gorilla sprayed Taylor with the fire hose in his cell, like I mentioned. Dodge does another one about Taylor when Dodge later screams, "It's a madhouse!" after riling up the apes, just like Taylor screams when he's getting hit with the fire hose after the gorilla separated him from Nova. But there was also nods in terms of the character, like Maurice, a noble orangutan and a trusted confidant of Caesar, was a reference to Maurice Evans, the actor who played Dr. Zaius, the orangutan in the 1968 film. Rocket was named after Norman Rocket, a set decorator on the franchise. And it's even referenced in little things like you might not catch, like the serum, ALZ-112. 112 minutes is the running time of the original Planet of the Apes. Actually, the story itself mirrors 1972's conquest of the Planet of the Apes in a few ways, too. In both films, Caesar was raised by a human, but loses faith in human kindness after realizing he is part of an oppressed minority, and then focuses on training and gathering other apes. Granted, in Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, Caesar takes over ape management to bolster his numbers. And in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Caesar's kind of already in ape management already. Lastly, Caesar leads a full-on revolt against the humans and takes the freedom rightfully owed to the apes in both Rise and Conquest.
That sounds about right to me. I think you have to be careful when planning Easter eggs, and this movie is an example of why, in both good and bad ways, there are a ton of Easter eggs to the original films, as you mentioned. Some of them land well, like the names, Cornelius, Maurice, Stephen Jacobs, a reference to Alan B. Jacobs, and so on. I think there's also a brief clip showing Charlton Heston in a movie called The Agony and the Ecstasy, which was a nice way of having Heston in there, and it's very blink and miss it. Other times I was taken out of the movie because the references were a little bit too on the nose, like Dodge landed twice citing classic lines from the Heston film, like you said. That kind of stuff gets a little on my nerves because it just reminds me of films that I'd rather be seeing instead most of the time. But this movie was good enough that I brushed those moments aside, and I got back into it once Rise started reminding me of what it was rebooting. I get that it's meant to be reverential and respectful to the original film, but it is possible to overdo it.
I can certainly understand that Dodd's direct quotes from Taylor in the 68 film could take you out of the moment. It did for me as well. That was an intense moment that was broken up by quoting Taylor and making the viewer think of the original film and not the intense moment between Dodge and Caesar going on right there. Personally, wasn't thinking I would rather be watching the original film when that happened, as I actually prefer the reboot franchise. But we can both agree that they laid it on a little thick. However, I believe they had the best intentions, as you said. But I would also like to talk about how certain things, despite being sacred to some, needed to be updated in the reboot. I talked earlier in part one about the three themes we see throughout the original films and how they were loosely tied to the fears of the day. Well, the Cold War ended in 1991, and we're not living in constant fear of the world destroying itself with nukes the way we were back then. However, we are quite afraid of a virus wiping out the planet, even more so in the years since 2011 when Rise came out. The themes that stuck are cruel and harsh slavery and animal cruelty or abuse, however you want to say it. This is particularly true in Rise and War for the Planet of the Apes. It is not leaned into as heavy as it was in the original films, but those themes are still in there nonetheless.
These films has aged a bit too well, scarily so, given the COVID pandemic and the fears that that caused. I agree that at the time, the nuclear war didn't seem like a very likely way for the world to end. I mean, nobody back in 2011 was really concerned about it since the end of the Cold War. But pandemics are kind of an evergreen threat, given that it's possible for new diseases to develop at any time. It also hits the threat of dangerous science, which is already an issue just with these super intelligent apes. I think you could probably do the nuclear option if you were to reboot it today, because the current world situation is making that fear more relevant again. But I think a virus that creates super apes and kills humans is a very good, convenient plot device to set up that kind of post-apocalyptic world.
Totally. The simian flu was a brilliant idea, and I tip my hat to the creator of that idea. I really loved that as well. Lastly, I have to say that something about the ending. Showing that pilot sick before getting on the plane was really effective. All you needed to see was that a commercial pilot caught the simian flu. You didn't have to pay actors or have special effects to sell you that scene. All you needed was a graphic designer and an animator, and you could easily explain how the more aggressive virus using to strengthen the ALZ-113 turns out to be a lethal plague called the simian flu when humans come into contact with it. You also see how quickly it spread, and that perfectly sets up the beginning for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
I generally like the way the virus was planted in the first film. I mean, you have a breach where Will's assistant ends up getting sick, and then he ends up spreading it through casual contact. I do think the safety and quarantine protocols at Genesis were really lax, but I'm willing to chalk it up to Jacobs only caring about costs and making money. I don't think he'd have put much thought into safety and containing a potential outbreak at all if he saw dollar signs in it. But I appreciated that hints of it are subtle and give the next film room to either use it or not as they needed to. But I think the way that they did it in the next movie was well done, too. So why don't we get into the second film in the trilogy?
Sure, Steve, I'd be glad to. 2014's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes was directed by Matt Reeves. Yes, that Matt Reeves from Cloverfield and the Batman. From a screenplay by Mark Bomback, Rick Jaffa, and Amanda Silver. In Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, it is 10 years after the events of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and ape society is well established and flourishing in the woods. Apes have learned sign language to communicate with each other, but you'll see callbacks to the old films and this one too, like the laws written on the wall of their city, Ape No Kill Ape. Originally, Ape Shall Never Kill Ape. But they also had apes together strong and knowledge is power. Meanwhile, humans have all but died out, and there is about a village worth of people struggling to survive in the ruins of San Francisco across the bay. This is in a way similar to Battle for the Planet of the Apes, where Caesar has started his new society years after the end of civilization, and Caesar does attempt to live at peace with the humans. Granted, in Battle, it was global nuclear war that had destroyed civilization, and Dawn, the apocalypse was the simian flu. But still, the film stars Andy Serkis as Caesar, Toby Kebbell as Koba, Jason Clark as Malcolm, the leader of the small group that forms a strong bond with Caesar and the other apes. Malcolm is Alexander's father and Ellie's husband. Gary Oldman as Dreyfus, an ex-police officer and the leader of the remaining human survivors. Kerry Russell as Ellie, a former nurse and at the Centers for Disease Control, Malcolm's wife and Alexander's stepmother. Toby Kebbell and Cody Smith McPhee as Alexander, Malcolm's son from previous marriage and Ellie's stepson.
You know, I'm inclined to think of Dawn as Battle for the Planet of the Apes done right. The premise isn't too far off, though the execution is decidedly a different take. Like Battle, Dawn shows what ape society becomes with Caesar as the leader after human civilization has fallen. Like Battle, the apes come into contact with humans and the conflict flows from that first contact experience. The difference is that here, the humans act from logical motivations and not from pointless self-destructive cruelty. The tension between the apes and the humans is caused by completely understandable reasons on both sides. Now, the humans need the hydroelective power that the apes are squatting on, and the apes are protecting their home. It makes a perfect sense as a setup, and the first act of violence is driven by irrational fear and not by hatred of the other. I really appreciated that, and I start to see why Matt Reeves started to take off as a filmmaker at this point.
That is a great comparison to Battle for the Planet of the Apes, and I agree with the whole setup is so much better in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I know that we both despise Governor Culp in Battle for the Planet of the Apes. He was just ridiculous. I mean, that war started over absolutely nothing, and the whole thing just didn't make any sense. But Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is definitely an example of how to do it well. You know, we talked earlier about how tactical of a thinker Caesar was during the battle on the Golden Gate Bridge, and he was. I'm not trying to take away from that, but Caesar is special, and I expected higher level thinking from him. But one of the more terrifying points in the movie for me was one that was seemingly mundane until it took a sharp turn, and that is when Koba killed those two men in the shooting range. He plays a playful, goofy monkey like he had done before to lower their guard and give him a false sense of security. I think this playful ape display gives the impression that Koba is trained, as you see him doing tricks. This helps remove our fear of the savage primal side of the ape, because they appear to be accustomed to humans. Then, still acting like the playful ape, Koba slyly grabs the AK-47 that was leaning against the wall next to him, and right up until he actually pulls the trigger, he doesn't break character. Why is this so scary, you ask? For me, it was realizing that Koba had that plan going into that situation, and he executed it perfectly. Not only does that show he's a lot smarter than we thought, I think being able to act like that in order to deceive on that level shows advanced cognitive processing. I mean, think about that. Koba played a character to deceive them, and it worked. They thought it was all just fun and games until Koba killed the first one. Then, wearing his true face full of hatred and malice, he stared into the eyes of his next victim. And surely, the realizations I'm describing fell on that soldier, too, and Koba waited until that terror filled his heart before he pulled the trigger.
That is a really great scene. I don't think that there's much question that Koba was starting down the dark path by the time that we get to that scene. There are some clear hints in that direction, and then you have Koba's big fight with the Caesar at the dam. Koba does seem to have some regret about losing Caesar's trust, but his fears of the humans and the trauma he suffered in captivity just overrides every other concern. I agree that when the moment finally hits, it's surprising and powerful. I felt like there was a shoe that was going to drop in that scene, but when it finally hits, it hits like a truck. Koba playing the funny little monkey as a way to get the humans to lower their guard and then kill them was really clever, brutal though it is. It also gives that moment of comedy before the tragedy hits, turning the whole scene around in one moment. At this point, Koba's crossed the Rubicon with Caesar. He has his war, and now he'll do whatever it takes to win it. But he wasn't always like that, was he?
No, he wasn't. Cooper really changed throughout the film. I like how you said that he started down a dark path. I think that's a great metaphor, actually, as he ends up being too blind to see anything but the darkness by the end. Who he is at the end of the film is in utter contrast to the Koba we saw at the beginning. Koba was Caesar's best friend. You saw how quickly Koba ran to protect Caesar and Blue Eyes from that big old bear. I have not personally stood before a giant bear, but I can tell you that I would be terrified if it did. And it looked like Caesar was pretty scared too, but he dove right in between the bear and his son because of how much he loved his son. In other words, his son's life was more valuable than his own. That may seem obvious, but consider that Koba was equally as fearless, diving in to protect his best friend. There was no hesitation in Koba. He dove spear first into that bear and killed it. I think Koba showed great love for both Caesar and Blue Eyes in that scene. But Koba kind of becomes General Aldo from Battle for the Planet of the Apes. Both Aldo and Koba hate humans and want to make war with them despite Caesar's wishes, and they both draw others to their rebellious cause. Both even plan and execute a coup d'etat in order to take control. And last but not least, both Aldo and Koba fall to their death after being let go by Caesar. Now consider the ending where Koba is hanging from the ledge and uses the number one law among apes as a desperate plea for his life. But I'm guessing Caesar went through the number of times he had forgiven Koba over the last several weeks, and how each time Koba was forgiven, he took his rebellion even farther than he had before, going as far as violating the very law he was using to plead for his own life. Then Koba even shot Caesar and tried to kill him. Even though it broke his heart and violated his own law about killing other apes, Caesar dropped Koba and told him that he was not an ape. His best friend turned against him in every way that a best friend can turn against someone. And I believe that because at that point, Caesar saw that Koba's death was for the good of his people. But it clearly haunted him as well, as we see in War for the Planet of the Apes, and ultimately corrupted him with the same disease of hatred that infected Koba. However, like Bilbo had pity on Gollum, so too was Caesar able to pity the Colonel when he found him in his room having fallen victim to the virus mutation. That did not stop the Colonel from killing himself because he hates what he has become, but it was pity that stayed Caesar's hand.
I always find it interesting that both stories involve an Andy Serkis character, but you're absolutely right on the battle comparisons. I mean, I do think that Battle was a template for this movie. I mean, as already mentioned, there are tons of parallels between the two films. I also think you're right that Koba does occupy the Aldo role. I find Koba more of a complicated character than Aldo is, because he wasn't always the Brutus character. You know, he did show loyalty and solidarity with Caesar in the early days, and the friendship between the two makes the division that much more painful and regrettable. But still, I'd have liked to see a little bit more of the old Koba in this movie than what we see here.
That would have been nice. I also think it would have turned up that final scene where Koba dies an extra notch and really, really driven home the emotional intensity of that moment. But I have to guess it was probably a running time consideration. Rise of the Planet of the Apes was an hour and 45 minutes. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes already exceeds that runtime by almost a half an hour without those extra scenes with a good Koba. But that's just a theory. So things seem to shift in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes as far as the perceptions of the apes and humans. I think at least part of the point of Rise was to show that humans can be monsters, as with the exception of a few. The more humane characteristics were portrayed by more apes than they were by humans. In fact, we can in some perspective see their cause as a righteous one, but that seems to change when we get to Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. There are large groups of apes who hate humans because of the things they have done to them in the past. This is particularly true of Koba and his message to the other apes. Caesar is distrusting of humans, but he does not hate them because he knows that there are good humans out there. Whereas apes like Koba didn't grow up in a loving human family like Caesar did. He grew up being abused and mutilated by humans in their experiments. It's hard to argue as he stands there pointing out all the scars he has from human work as he talks to Caesar. Those scars speak volumes about his argument. Koba only knows hate, which ultimately springs from fear. And in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, we see what effects of fear can have on an ape and human alike. Carver totally controlled his fears. Snuck a shotgun onto the worksite, even though it could potentially mean everyone at their compound might lose power and the ability to contact the outside world to see if there were any survivors. And then to protect that deception, he made a move on Caesar's son. I mean, how stupid was that? Which in turn put fear in Caesar's heart, and he attacked Carver. Then Koba, also inspired by great fear in the form of hatred, was willing to burn down Ape City, shoot and attempt to kill Caesar, and even kill other apes like Ash for protesting against his blind rage. But Koba has a mirror in the human faction as well, in the form of Dreyfus, the leader. Koba has physical scars and horrid memories of what humans are like, and he fears what they could do if even given an inch. Dreyfus feels very similar to Koba, except that he sees apes and he thinks of the simian flu and the destruction it caused on the world as he knew it, including the death of his family. They really make it seem as if rebuilding the world is a primary goal for him. Like Koba, Dreyfus can see nothing else, even his own friend Malcolm, who founded the city with him, can't convince him not to kill the apes. Caesar admits to his son Blue Eyes that he was willing to trust Koba simply because he was an ape, and Caesar believed apes were better than humans. But as he lay there, gripping onto life because of the bullet Koba put in him, he was taken care of and kept alive by humans. With all that Koba had done and planned to do, Caesar saw how much apes and humans actually have in common. This actually mirrors the sentiment from the original 68 film about coming to the realization of how animal-like humans actually are. In other words, there are good and bad ones alike among both groups. Fear of the past pain created hatred towards anything like what caused it, and that is what is causing all of this on both sides.
I think we have to go back to the wisdom of Master Yoda on this one. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. On both sides, we see that fear is the catalyst for the two sides leading to violence. The only reason that the humans originally shot Rocket's child was purely because the guy was afraid of the apes. And that's not an entirely irrational fear. I mean, a bunch of giant intelligent apes in the wild would be pretty scary. The humans have other fears, especially the fears that their attempts to save civilization will fall apart because they don't have the power to keep society running. And then from the apes' perspective, they're understandably afraid of humans turning to violence against them, because that's all many of them have ever known. For some of the apes, like Koba, that fear has turned to hate because of what they've suffered through. It's a cycle that has no ending, and this movie is ultimately about how sometimes how even well-meaning people can fall victim to that cycle. Now, I think it goes back to Governor Breck's speech in Conquest, and the idea that the humans' hatred of the apes stems from the hatred of the violence in themselves. I did this movie because I feel like it shows how this kind of hatred would realistically come to pass.
Dawn of the Planet of the Apes a lot myself. As you mentioned, it takes a lot more realistic view of the destructive and blinding powers of hatred. And you get bonus points for the perfect Yoda quote for that. I know you're probably wanting to jump right into War of the Planet of the Apes, but we have to take a quick side note before we get into it. You see, there was a 5-issue Planet of the Apes Star Trek crossover published by IDW the same year that Dawn of the Planet of the Apes came out in 2014, called, and I love this, The Primate Directive. That's just perfect. But this was not just a crossover of sci-fi franchises. This was also a crossover of publishers. You see, IDW Publishing had the rights to Star Trek, and Boom Studios had the rights to Planet of the Apes. The book was written by my friend Scott Tipton and his brother David Tipton. Apparently, the story goes that IDW's editor-in-chief, Chris Ryle, mentioned the notion of Star Trek Planet of the Apes crossover to the Tiptons following the success of Star Trek The Next Generation, Doctor Who Assimilation, to the Power of Two, I guess that is. They were puzzled by the idea of gelling together the two disparate visions of the future, but realized that as alternate timelines were part of the fabric of Star Trek, it was worth attempting. They opted to cross over the original versions of both series, as they were deemed the most iconic, and because of their roots in the culture of the 1960s. According to David Tipton, the plot involves the Klingons secretly backing a renegade guerrilla general in a coup for control of Ape City. Captain Kirk finds himself in the uncomfortable position of having to help Dr. Zaius Orangutan, and Taylor won't be happy with that.
While I've not read this series, it sounds like they had a lot of fun in making it. I mean, I actually could see how a crossover like this could potentially work in theory. I mean, both Apes and Trek deal with time travel, and this isn't the first time that a Federation starship got lost in the wrong timeline. I could even see the Guardian of Forever opening a portal into the Apes' future, or even it being like Hugh or Trelane throwing the Enterprise there. There are many, many ways you can make a crossover like that work. I'll also add that the idea of Kirk and Taylor having a team up is a neat idea. The interesting thing about that is that while they're both astronauts and explorers, they have drastically different views of humanity. I mean, Kirk is much more of an optimist and he believes in the Federation's ideals. Taylor is a complete pessimist and he only sees the worst in people. I think they'd have a lot to argue about, and Kirk wouldn't put up with Taylor's nonsense, but they'd also work together towards similar ideals at the end of the day. And Kirk is the kind of hero who fits the tone of Apes. I mean, he's got a lot of pretty violent instincts in him, as much as he tries to embody the Starfleet ideal. I would also love to see Spock have a debate with Dr. Zaius, because he'd undoubtedly win the logical argument. So I'd say there's definitely a story there.
It has been a few years since I read it, but as I recall, it was pretty good. I seem to remember some of that stuff with Taylor and Kirk as well. But I only read it once about 5 years ago. I'll have to go back and dig it up again. I'd really like to see Spock argue with Zaius. And I don't remember what happened. I ran out of room and started storing my comics down below, and I've kind of forgotten about them. But this has inspired me.
Yeah, for me as well. I mean, it's an idea that seems a bit silly on the surface, but when you think about it, there's real substance there to explore. I mean, it inspires a lot of ideas when you sit down and really think about the connections. I mean, maybe one day I'll get around to reading that series, but we'll see. But there's still one more film on our list, Mike. So what are your thoughts on that one?
I enjoyed War for the Planet of the Apes. They set it up real nicely with the end of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and the army from the north coming down to San Francisco. But we'll get into that in a bit more detail in a minute. For now, we need to cover some of the facts. War for the Planet of the Apes is the third film in the reboot franchise, and it hit theaters in 2017. The film would be the final installment in what would be the Rise trilogy. It was once again directed by Matt Reeves, although this time Reeves co-wrote the screenplay with Mark Baumbach. This is a notable change, as up to this point, the screenplay had been written by Jaffa and Amanda Silver, and you can tell that there's a different there are different writers on War of the Planet of the Apes. That is not to impugn Reeves and Baumbach's script in any way. I'm just saying that War felt like a different flavor than I was used to from the reboot franchise. Andy Serkis, of course, came back to play Caesar. Toby Kebbell came back as Koba in Caesar's dream sequences. Judy Greer comes back as Cornelia. Yes, that same Judy Greer from the recent Halloween trilogy. Steve Zahn plays a hilarious yet adorable character in The Bad Ape. And last but not least, Woody Harrelson plays a despicable villain in The Colonel, the leader of the Alpha Omega rogue military faction.
The Alpha Omega name is a clear reference to Beneath the Planet of the Apes and the mutant nuclear cult. And there's some other parallels there, but we'll get to those in a minute. But it's clear that there were three main influences on the story that shine through. One was Bridge on the River Kwai, which Reeves was an influence, though I think it's the least notable of them. The other two are very obvious, which are The Great Escape and Apocalypse Now. The scene in the quarantine camp are very much out of Great Escape, with the Nazi imagery of the camp scenes and Caesar being blatantly placed in the role of Steve McQueen. Apocalypse Now is openly referenced in one of the tunnel scenes. I mean, Apocalypse Now, quote unquote, is even spray painted on the tunnel wall. But I think it's mainly apparent with Colonel McCullough as the Colonel Kurtz figure and the way certain scenes are shot. The scene where the Colonel is in full camo makeup during the raid on Ape City looks a lot like Martin Sheen at the end of Apocalypse Now. So this is pretty much a war movie dressed up as a post-apocalyptic ape movie.
Very much so. And I think that is actually why they named it War for the Planet of the Apes. Well, that and it being a play on Battle for the Planet of the Apes. As to the film influences, particularly as it pertains to Apocalypse Now, even Woody Harrelson has acknowledged those influences. And speaking of influences, did you happen to notice the Moses figure in Caesar at the end of War? He literally frees his people from captivity, leads his people across the desert to the planet's Promised Land, and dies on a mountain before getting to enter the Promised Land with his people. Like Moses raged, and like Moses, rage caused him to sin and ended up keeping him from entering the promised land. It was even Caesar's rage that put him in the situation where he got shot with the arrow and died before entering the promised land. I don't know about you, but as soon as I saw that scene with him dying at the end, it all fell into place. I actually looked it up, and Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments is actually listed among the influences for the film, along with others. Apparently, Reeves and Bomback got Fox to lend them a theater, and they just watched countless movies looking for inspiration for War for the Planet of the Apes. They, of course, watched those three films you already mentioned, as well as Paths of Glory, Spartacus, Ben-Hur, Unforgiven, and a bunch of others. But there were some influences that made it into the film directly. For instance, Caesar's journey to kill the colonel, flanked by a posse of close friends, was something Reeves specifically tied to Clint Eastwood's war-weary soldier in The Outlaw Josie Wales. Speaking of influences, though, there was another big influence on the film, and that is 1973's Battle for the Planet of the Apes. Both films start out with Caesar living with his wife and son Cornelius years after the apocalypse. This similarity is carried over from Dawn. In both films, Caesar has built a new society and attempts to do his best to live in peace with humans.
Battle was definitely on Reeves' mind, and I think we see that in Dawn as well. I think this is where a remake is done right, when you take a movie that didn't work previously and make it work the way it was intended to. But to answer your question, yes, the biblical parallels are very clear, and I agree that Caesar is very much the Moses figure. I mean, they do mix their metaphors a bit here, though, as he's also given some Christ imagery, including the scenes where Caesar is crucified. That was a bit too on the nose, and I don't think it was needed. I think Caesar is more of a Moses allegory, which, given that Moses is one of Charlton Heston's most notable roles, is kind of appropriate. Caesar leads his people out of bondage and into the promised land, but he does get to enjoy it himself. That pretty much is the Moses story, and Caesar plays it well.
He really does, and it fits very nicely into the story they're telling. Caesar very much represents those things to the apes. But if I could switch topics a little bit here and talk about some hints towards the future. You see them clearly planting seeds in this film for a future film more akin to the original Planet of the Apes from 1968 by introducing Cornelius and giving the blonde-haired girl the name Nova. Nova, as you know, was Taylor's girlfriend in the 68 film. In fact, it would seem that they're essentially saying that the event is just a decade or two away, considering the age of young Nova. But Reeves has flat out said that she is not the Nova from the 68 film. But then the Colonel foretells a future where Earth becomes a planet of the apes and humans become cattle.
The logical next step is Cornelius growing up and taking his father's place as leader of the apes. I don't think the girl was ever supposed to be Linda Harrison's Nova character either, but she was clearly meant to evoke that character. I was curious about the significance of Nova and why they added her into the film. I suspected that there was probably a major reveal about her that they were holding back. And if you look at the pieces, they're all there. Nova and her father were trying to get away from the Colonel because she was a carrier for the evolved Sevian flu. The doll she's carrying is stained with infected blood, and then she drops it in Caesar's cell, where it's found by the Colonel. So she ends up being the one who becomes the Colonel's doom, because she infects him with the virus that he was trying to eradicate all along. It's interesting how this very minor, seemingly insignificant character plays such a huge role by the end of the film.
That was one hell of a reveal, too. It honestly took me a minute to pick up on. I didn't even think about the doll carrying the mutated virus when he first picked it up in the cell. But not only was it clever, I thought the Colonel killing himself at the end was poetic and, at a fractional degree, mildly redemptive. When he said that he'd killed his own child because he caught the virus, not out of pity but out of hate, you instantly hate him. And while it would not be enough to save him, I can at least respect that he had the balls to issue the same death on himself. At least he's not a hypocrite, is all I'm saying.
Well, the Colonel may be insane, but it's a consistent kind of insanity. I think he was driven by a fear of losing everything that made him human because he saw what that did to his son. So he takes that to such a degree that he's willing to kill anyone or anything if it means that no other human is ever infected with the simian flu. I found a certain poetic justice in watching the Colonel suffer the same fate he's inflicted on so many innocent people. I also like that the film makes you wonder, for just a moment, if he was going to fire at Caesar, but he doesn't. And I can't help but wonder if the Colonel is showing some respect for his enemy when he realizes that his end has come.
Actually, I think that fits. The Colonel clearly respected Caesar, especially after having talked with him. He was surprised how intelligent and insightful Caesar was, and he didn't even attack Caesar when Caesar lunged at him. I think you're right on the nose with that one. In War of the Planet of the Apes, they introduced an ape called Bad Ape, who says that as the virus spread, humans got sick, but apes got smart. I actually had not considered that before. I had thought the group with Caesar was special because they or their descendants were exposed to the ALZ-113. But once that serum was attached to a highly aggressive virus to carry it and spread it around the world, that totally makes sense. The apes could get exposed to the ALZ-113, just like catching a flu. But it's not harmful to simians. I actually thought that was pretty brilliant, and I felt a bit stupid for not having seen it before. What's more is that they use ALZ-113 to explain why humans are primitive and mute when we see them in the 1968 film. The virus that all human survivors still carry had mutated and began robbing humans of their higher thinking and brought them back to a level much like what we see in our time. Essentially, ALZ-113 is a catalyst for the Planet of the Apes franchise in this reboot.
I thought that made perfect sense, honestly. I mean, Will Rodman used a highly advanced strain of virus as a carrier, and that's how it enacts the gene therapy. It makes sense that since the ALZ-113 enhances ape intelligence but kills humans, that the simian flu would carry the effects of the 113 on the apes as well. So it's very possible that by the end of war, the simian flu has become so widespread that it's enhanced the intelligence of apes on a global scale. We know that the spread of the virus reached pandemic levels. The idea that the virus mutated and its effects on humans got worse also made sense. Will's father suffered similar effects because his body adapted to the 112 virus, and he gradually lost his cognitive functions after initially showing improvement. So it could be that the 113 is an advanced form of the same side effect, where it breaks down higher functions, much like what happened to John Lithgow in Rise.
That certainly sounds possible and probably true to some extent, but I believe that the simian flu, like all flus, mutated and changed over time. The original strain is what decimated the population, but those that remained, according to Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, were immune to the first strain of the virus. The virus they used on the 112 was not aggressive enough to sustain the effects of the gene therapy. It was the highly aggressive virus that carried the ALZ-113 that mutated and caused what we see in War for the Planet of the Apes. But I do believe you are correct as what the mutation was actually doing to the human mind.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable to me. But like the other films, there are quite a few Easter eggs, and we have talked about a few of them, but I think there are more you wanted to mention, Mike.
Yes, I do, Steve. War of the Planet of the Apes had a couple callbacks to the originals that we haven't talked about yet. For instance, that doll that Maurice gives to Nova and ultimately ends up in the hands of the Colonel, giving him the virus, was a callback to the doll found in the cave at the end of the 68 film that Taylor pointed out could not have been made by apes as the human doll talks. The military group led by the Colonel is called the Alpha and Omegas, which is a reference to the letters on the bomb worshipped by the cult from beneath the Planet of the Apes.
The callbacks were done better in this film than in some of the previous films we've talked about. I mean, there were cool smaller references, but they didn't go too far with it, and it didn't take me out of the film. I think by the time they got to this movie, Reeves had figured out how much to include and how much to leave out.
It would seem so. After two films, they could dial it back some and found a proper balance. Shortly before the release of War in July 2017, Reeves said that he expressed interest in making more apes films and that Steve Zahn, who played Bad Ape in the film, had set up a story for further sequels. During an interview of Andy Serkis with MTV in mid-November 2014, Serkis talked about possible sequels. It might be three films, it could be four, it could be five, who knows? The journey will continue, is what he said. Writer Mark Baumbach hinted that the films would be possible, that more films would be possible, saying, truthfully, we haven't had those kinds of conversations. I've been working on these films for about 7 years now, and I'm ready to take a breather and let things rest a bit. But in 2019, after their acquisition of Fox, Disney announced that they plan to make more Planet of the Apes movies set in the same Rise of the Planet of the Apes universe that story writer-director Wes Ball would be writing on a new sequel. In February of 2020, it was reported that Joe Hartwick Jr. and David Stark were coming on to produce the sequel, and writer-director Wes Ball announced that the film would follow the events of War for the Planet of the Apes and center around Caesar's legacy. In May 2020, Ball also revealed that Josh Friedman would write the screenplay, and previous writers Jaffa and Silver would return as producers. On the 26th of May, Ball also said that while the film will be set in the same universe as Rise, the film won't be a direct sequel to War, saying that the film will feel like a follow-up to the overall Rise trilogy. But at the same time, the filmmakers will do some really cool new stuff for the film. Virtual production, or rather CGI work from the new film, began soon afterwards, despite the COVID-19 pandemic. In a March 2022 interview with The Hollywood Reporter, 20th Century Studios president Steve Asbell stated that production would start between the late summer and early fall of 2022, and that is what's happening from what I understand. It was announced back in August of this year that 24-year-old Owen Teague would be playing Caesar's son, Cornelius, and I think that gives us an idea how far after War of the Planet of the Apes we're talking about it, but with Owen's age. But you might recognize Owen Teague from It Chapters 1 and 2, where he played one of the bullies named Patrick Hoxadder.
It looks like a new film is likely to happen, with this one called Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Personally, I hope whatever they do, they don't try to ape, no pun intended, the story of the first movie, because I don't think it can go back to that well again. That said, I wouldn't mind seeing the Ape City of 3995 in a future film and some exploration of what the world would be like in the far future. I mean, now that they're free of the mess that Beneath made of the franchise, we can see more of that, what that setting has to offer. I mean, what else might the virus have done to humanity? And could it have created a race of mutants? What happened to the other parts in the world? And could there be other pockets of human civilization that survived? If the simian flu mutated apes from across the world, are there other ape tribes that are out there? I feel like there are plenty of possibilities for the future of the Apes universe if they play their cards right.
There is a lot left to explore, and I'm equally as excited to see more of what could have been if not for Beneath the Planet of the Apes. The other ape tribes is really going to be interesting as well. I mean, that could play on how key a figure Caesar is to ape society. I mean, we could see what ape tribes would have been like without his influence. With them talking about Caesar's legacy, I can totally see that fitting in there. It's like that X-Men episode we talked about where we saw how important Charles Xavier is. But I don't think they're going to go quite as far into the future to see 3995 Ape City we saw in Beneath the Planet of the Apes. From what I can glean from casting Owen Teague as Cornelius, I think we're looking more at about 20 years after War of the Planet of the Apes. My guess, and mind you, I'm just speculating, is that society will be more like the younger version of Ape City we saw in Battle for the Planet of the Apes, but with Cornelius in charge since his father is dead.
I agree. It is more likely that we're just going to see a fallout from the last film with Cornelius and Maurice in charge of the apes. I mean, we'll probably see an adult Nova by then as well, and it's possible we'll see her take a bigger role in the tribe. Even with that setup, though, there's plenty of room for them to go. I mean, there could be any number of other people, I mean, humans or apes, that could stumble on the new kingdom. I mean, thinking about it now, I feel like this is essentially the ape version of the Lion King. Cornelius now rules over everything the light touches after his father sacrificed himself for the survival of their tribe. I mean, there's some real possibilities in that, too.
Wow. I really like that Simba and Mufasa comparison. But before we wrap up, I'd like to take a minute to give our final thoughts on the reboot franchise. Overall, I'm a much bigger fan of the new franchise than I am of the original franchise. It is in part because the original five films were very much a product of their time, and the new franchise fits much better into ours. Plus, I feel like the creator of the Rise franchise learned from the mistakes of the original film and fixed them or improved the story to not need them. I think that my favorite in the series so far is Rise of the Planet of the Apes, but unlike the original five, I have liked every entry in the reboots. How about you, Steve? What are your closing thoughts on the films?
I have a very strong fondness for the original 68 film, and I don't think that there are many films that can ever have the impact that movie did. At the same time, the later films are far better than I would have expected them coming in. I don't think the series has a Blade Runner or Daredevil level of consistency, but that is an extremely high bar that is very difficult to achieve. Despite that, most of the weaker films are at least worth watching once for the most part, aside from maybe the Reardon remake. There's always something I can appreciate in most of these films, however flawed they are. I mean, even a film like Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which was torched because of behind-the-scenes studio disputes, still has a lot of things I enjoy despite that mess of an ending. And when these films are good, they are very well made, and they have real emotional and thematic impact. You have a lot of solid and consistent writers and directors on this series that get what these films are about, and it really leans into what makes the concept work. I come away with a decent respect for this series, despite its imperfections.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. That's a respectable position. That about wraps up part two of our Planet of the Apes discussion, though. Thanks for hanging out with us, and we'll see you next time. But I'd like to take this moment before we wrap up to say thank you to our patrons who made this podcast possible. I hope you've enjoyed hanging out with us on ORP today. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to please share this episode and help us get the word out.
That is indeed a big help, and we want to thank you in advance for your support of both listening and sharing this episode. It means a lot to us, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.